Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. And now, after somewhat long interval, we come back to the Mahasakaludayi Sutta, and we're now in what should be the very last part of the sutta. We've gone through all the different practices. Coming up, we're on page 642, section 12, paragraph 29. And this begins a group of practices or attainments which are collectively call them the eight higher knowledges. In Pali, they would be called the Atta Bija. I'll write that. Okay, and these eight higher knowledges include within them a group of six. The more common is a group of six, which collectively are called the six direct knowledges, chel abhinya. So the usual set of six direct knowledges, or six super knowledges, begin from paragraph 14 and go to paragraph 19, section 19. But sometimes these six super knowledges are preceded by two other higher knowledges, which are here called insight knowledge and the mind-made body. And before I discuss these higher knowledges individually, I think maybe some preliminary words are called for about them. Because usually when we start reading about Buddhism, particularly when we read about early Buddhism, the way it's presented by most Western writers on early Buddhism, it's explained as a quite rational, down-to-earth, sensible, direct, straightforward way to liberation from suffering, and it's supposed to get rid of all sorts of mystical, magical, supernatural elements. You know, it's just be aware of your body, feelings, states of mind, mental objects. This gives you insight, wisdom, and this purifies the mind of defilements, and then you get liberation. And yet when you read the Buddhist texts, the suttas, you'll see again and again that mention is made of these higher knowledges or supernatural power, supernormal powers or super knowledges. And if we read the story literature of Buddhism, apart from the suttas, the narrative literature, one sees that quite a lot of emphasis is placed upon the acquisition of these supernormal abilities. And in the popular understanding in Buddhist countries, like the mark of a real arhant is the ability to fly through the sky. And if one doesn't have that ability, then it's not the real thing. And so if Buddhism becomes very widespread, it's going to drive Virgin Airlines and United Airlines and all those other airlines, EVA Airlines, China Airlines, whatever, drive them all out of business. Okay, so the way I try to conceive the goals in early Buddhism, I have a picture of three goals, or let's say objectives in early Buddhism, graded. I would grade them in sequence according to their relative importance. Okay, the first goal, what I might call the ultimate or highest goal for early Buddhism, I call this mastery over the process of samsaric becoming, or mastery over the round of rebirths. And this means, in effect, liberation from the process of rebirth. And this is to be achieved by eliminating or eradicating the defilements of the mind. Okay, the second is mastery over the range of the mind. And this means that there are many different dimensions or domains of consciousness. These are the domains of meditative experience. Meditative experience in the field of samadhi, concentration. And particularly here, we mention the four jhanas, the four absorptions, the four formless attainments, and the state called the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling. These are grouped together sometimes as the eight attainments, that's the four jhanas and the four formless attainments, or the eight liberations that we have. We've gone through these in section 8 of the sutta. And then the third area in which accomplishment is seen as a positive goal is what I call, or what we might call, mastery over natural phenomena, or mastery over natural processes. And this means that it's considered a positive good for a meditator, a monk, to be able to have such skill in the mastery of the mind that he can use his mind to control and transform natural processes in the ways described in some of the knowledges that we come to in the sections that we're going to study tonight. And this mastery of the mind, or mastery over natural processes, is made possible by the fact that mastery over the mind opens up a very deep understanding of certain hidden laws that govern the material universe. laws that are usually or always hidden from us and that cannot be discovered even by the most astute, the most skilled scientists. And through achieving these deep states of mental concentration, deep samadhi, one is able to gain direct access to these hidden laws, I call them occult laws, that govern the workings of the material universe. And one can then manipulate these laws, use them, bend them, twist them in ways that will defy the workings of the ordinary conceptual mind. But then the question might come up, well, before I come to that question, let me just go through and say, okay, a meditator does not have to achieve accomplishment in category 2 and category number 3 in order to fulfill the final aim of the Buddha's teaching. That is, the Buddha's teaching recognizes that different people have different capacities, different aptitudes, and the Buddha doesn't expect everybody to achieve mastery in all three areas. The Buddha's final aim is liberation from dukkha, the achievement of nibbana. And so one who achieves the first goal without achieving the other two goals is called one who is liberated by wisdom. Technically, it's panya vimutta. This disciple might develop one of the four jhanas, or according to the commentaries, it's possible even without developing any jhana, simply on the basis of access concentration, and then using one of those four jhanas or access concentration as a basis to develop panya, to develop wisdom, and through that wisdom one eradicates the defilements and gains liberation. Okay, but there are some disciples who do go on to gain a more total mastery over the mind. They are able to attain and become skilled to develop the skills in all these different attainments, meditative attainments, in the sphere of samadhi. They achieve the jhanas, the four jhanas, they achieve the four formless attainments, they go on to achieve, some even achieve the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling. So those who achieve mastery, who achieve both liberation, final liberation, and who also achieve this mastery over the range of the mind, these are known as technically both ways liberated arahants. Ubhato, technically it's called Ubhato Bhagavimutta. Okay, then a high degree of accomplishment in samadhi and even accomplishment in all of these eight attainments is the prerequisite for achieving this mastery over natural phenomena, for achieving the supernormal or spiritual powers. And those who achieve the spiritual powers, these are called, sometimes they're called six powered, or arhants who have the six direct knowledges. In Pali it's called Chalabhinya arhants. And some might even go on to get the other two knowledges. They're called eight. I don't think that there's a distinct class, eight Vijja arhants. The usual is just the six Chalabhinya, six direct knowledge arhants. Okay, then the question might come up, what is the purpose of having these super knowledges? For one thing, it can and should be said that to have these super knowledges without having a high degree of purity of mind is possible. But also it's regarded as very dangerous, very risky. Because one who develops, one can develop these super knowledges with a wrong motivation, and then if one does so, those super knowledges can become a means for leading one into dangerous behavior that will lead one to lower states of rebirth. One example, as mentioned, is the case of Devadatta, who is the Buddha's ambitious cousin. He developed the super knowledges, or some of them he developed very early in his career. But because of that, he became swollen with conceit. He thought he was a very spiritually developed person. And then he thought that he could take over the Buddhist order, and so he tried to convince the Buddha that he should seek early retirement so that he himself could take over as the head of the Sangha. And then when the Buddha didn't show any interest in taking early retirement, then Devadatta tried to kill the Buddha in order to get rid of him. And there are many cases mentioned in the Buddha stories and also in the whole literature of Indian spirituality of yogis who develop these powers and then use them for bad purposes. And also, even though one might not have a bad intention, but one can develop these superior powers, these supernormal powers, but if the mind is not purified of the defilements, one could easily fall from one's spiritual powers and then just become an ordinary person. The famous story, I think it comes in the Pali commentaries, is told of a young novice who early as a meditator he developed these supernormal powers so that he could fly through the sky. Then one day while he was flying through the sky, he heard a young peasant girl working in the fields was singing a song. He heard the sweet melody floating up into the air, and he wondered, what is that sound, that sweet sound? And he came down to find out. Then he saw the peasant girl, and then fell in love with her, and then went back to his master and said, "Venerable Sir, I give up my robes and I want to marry that peasant girl." Okay, so the attainment of the supernormal powers is not in itself a mark of perfect achievement. It's not a mark of holiness. But the Buddhist texts consider it to be, I would call it, a sign of spiritual accomplishment, not necessary for liberation, but perhaps in India, in the time in which the Buddha appeared, many of the yogis had mastered these spiritual attainments. And for them it was considered the mark of attainment, of true attainment, to have these super knowledges. So if the Buddha himself appeared on the scene and didn't have them, people would think, how could he claim to be an enlightened one? He can't fly through the sky, he can't multiply the body, he can't read the minds of others. And so the Buddha, in order to fulfill the expectations of people as to the mark of an enlightened person, would have had to achieve these supernormal powers, and also many of his accomplished disciples would have had to fulfill them. And also, I would say that it is the achievement of these spiritual powers that enables a yogi or a meditator to work in many ways that are more effective for the promotion and dissemination of the Dhamma, but working generally in hidden ways, not making an ostentatious display of these powers. There is one sutta in the Digha Nikaya, I think it's sutta number 11. Yes, it is sutta number 11. Some devotee of the Buddha comes to the Buddha and says, appeals to the Buddha to use his supernormal powers to win over many of the people in, I think it's the city of Vaisali. And the Buddha says, no, I won't use my supernormal powers to win them over. Then the devotee appeals to the Buddha, use your powers of mind reading to win over many people. If many people see you using your powers of mind reading, they'll think, ah, you are truly the Buddha, and they'll become your followers. And then the Buddha says, no, I won't use the miracle of mind reading to win people over. And so then the devotee says, well, you won't use the miracle of supernormal powers, you won't use the miracle of mind reading, so what kind of miracle are you going to use to win people over? Then the Buddha says, I don't think much of the miracle of supernormal powers, I don't think much of the miracle of mind reading, but the miracle that I really esteem is the miracle of instruction, that is, the ability to teach people, this is what is harmful, this is what is beneficial, if you do this, it will lead to your harm, to suffering, to your loss, if you do this, it will lead to your benefit, to your happiness, to your gain. That, the Buddha said, is what I consider the true miracle. But even though the Buddha said that on this occasion, but if we read other Buddhist texts, other texts, we see occasionally the Buddha does use his supernormal powers, not so much to win people over, but he does use them for certain purposes. And there's certain occasions when the Buddha comes into a contest with important teachers from the other sects, in which they are using their spiritual powers to show how powerful they are, and then the Buddha, of course, he has to outdo them by using his spiritual powers to show that he can perform wondrous feats that are more mind-boggling, more wonderful, more outstanding than anything that they can accomplish. Okay, so from this, let us examine these higher knowledges or spiritual powers. Okay, the first one we come to is called insight knowledge. And this doesn't seem to have anything especially super normal about it. The Buddha says to Udayin, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to understand thus, this body of mine made of material form, consisting of material form, consisting of the four great elements, procreated by a mother and father, and built up out of boiled rice and porridge, is subject to impermanence, to being worn and rubbed away, to dissolution and disintegration, and this consciousness of mine is supported by it and bound up with it. Then he uses an example, a simile, of a beryl gem, a very high quality gem, and through it a thread is strung. And then a man with good sight might take that gem in his hand, look at it, and see this is the beryl gem of purest quality, and this is the thread that is running through it. Blue, yellow, red, white, or brown thread. Here the gem represents the body, and the thread running through the gem represents consciousness. And so according to the commentary, this knowledge or higher knowledge is said to be Vipassana jnana, that is, insight knowledge. And it's explained simply as the discrimination, the distinction of the body consisting of the four great elements and consciousness. But I'm a little bit doubtful that this should actually be understood to be insight knowledge. Because later on, at the very end, mention is made of the knowledge of the destruction of the taints, of the defilements. And with this, we can understand the insight knowledge to be included. So it would be puzzling to me that insight knowledge should again be mentioned separately. It can just be that this ability to use the power, strong power of samadhi, and then to look at the body, and then to see very clearly, almost visibly, the distinction between the body and consciousness, that can be considered just a superior knowledge in its own right. It doesn't have to be seen as an insight knowledge. And usually insight knowledge is explained as the knowledge of the five aggregates being subject to arising and passing away. And here, this knowledge is not explained in those terms. But there's nothing in this knowledge itself that seems particularly supernormal or beyond, say, the range of ordinary conception of our imagination as to what is possible. It just seems to be a very highly refined knowledge possible when the mind becomes strongly concentrated. Does anybody have any questions or comments about this? Ken?
And it says that subject to impermanence itself, isn't it related to the insight?
Yeah, that seems to introduce a note that could connect it to insight knowledge, but that being subject to impermanence, notice it's ascribed only to the body here. It's not really something that's ascribed to, it doesn't develop in the usual questionnaire, the way the Buddha develops it. Form is impermanent, suffering, not mine, not I, not self. It's not yet developed in that way. So it might be that this is actually the beginning of insight knowledge, but I'm just a little doubtful of it. But I should say that that is the way it is explained in the commentary.
Tom? It also seems to like allude to the other self by just being a, the idea about the other self seems to come out to me.
Just to there being the body and the consciousness. Yeah, one could see that the idea of non-self, it's already implicit there, but it's not brought out as explicitly as it would be in the ordinary way of explaining the development of insight.
It would contrast to that, he says, this body of mine and this consciousness of mine, which is sort of a direct contrast to what he says. Is it proper to see something that's in front of your mind?
Yeah, that is so.
The Anatta teaching in that sense.
Okay, I don't want to dwell too long on this. So let us then move on to the next, which is in section 13. It's called the mind-made body. Mano-mai-kaya. Okay, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to create from this body, that's from one's normal physical body, another body having form. That is, that other body is a form body. It's not just a mental imagination, but it's mind made. It's created by the mind with all its limbs, that it's an exact replica of one's own physical body, lacking no faculty. That is, it has, or it appears to have, all of the faculties of the ordinary body. It appears with eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin. And then the text gives some similes, just as though a man were to pull out a reed from its sheath, and he might think thus, this is the sheath, this is the reed, the sheath is one, the reed is another, it is from the sheath that the reed has been pulled out. And so the sheath is like the ordinary physical body, and the reed that has been pulled out is like this mind-made body. Or again, it's just as if a man were to pull a sword out from its scabbard, that is, from its sheath or case. And he might think thus, the sword is one thing, the scabbard is another. It is from the scabbard that the sword has been pulled out. Or just as though a man were to pull a snake out of its slough, is that pronounced, or slow, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. Nobody can help me with this. Slough, I think. And think thus. You see how difficult the language English is? To pull a snake out of its slough and think thus, this is the snake, this is the slough, the snake is one, the slough is another, it is from the slough that the snake has been pulled out. So I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to create from this body another body, having form, mind made, with all its limbs, lacking no faculty. And thereby many disciples of mine abide, having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. Okay, so this body, this mind-made body, it's a body having form, exact replica of the physical body, and once it's extracted from the physical body, this is my understanding and the way it's explained in the commentaries, the yogi, the meditator, is able to direct it mentally so that it can appear to act on its own, it can move about, it can travel to distant places, can do things, but all the time it doesn't have a mind of its own. It's always, it's mentally controlled by the meditator, who is aware of what is taking place in the mind-made body. In some way, his mind is functioning in both bodies at the same time. Or perhaps the mind, since he's developed this body while in a state of samadhi, perhaps his mind goes into a state of suspension in his actual physical body and now operates in the mind-made body. But the mind, of course, really belongs to his natural physical body. But temporarily it utilizes this mind-made body for its own purposes. And so it might use this mind-made body to travel to distant places. It can appear to teach the Dhamma to people in these other places while the meditator is still sitting, perhaps in his hut, perhaps under a tree. And then when it served its purposes, then he withdraws that mind-made body, returns it, comes back into his physical body, and then he resumes his normal activities with his mind in his physical body. Okay, then we come to what are called the iddhi. Yeah.
Maybe it's a quick question. On the mind-made body, I was reading in the Digha Nikaya the Potapada Sutta.
Yeah.
And he mentions there are three kinds of acquired self, the gross acquired self, and then there is again this phrase, the mind-made acquired self.
Yeah.
And the formless acquired self.
Yeah.
And that seemed to have a different connotation.
There it has a different connotation.
Okay, so it is. It's a different mind-made.
Yeah. That is, the form of existence that takes place in the Brahma world as a result of developing the jhanas here. That's the way I would understand it.
Okay,
now we come to the section on the types of the iddhis. These are what are called the supernormal powers. And when you read these, you might think that it's impossible, really, for any human being to develop these powers. It might seem like myths and legends of ancient India. Okay, to have one body, one displays many bodies, one pulls in these many bodies into one's one body. One appears and vanishes. One goes unhindered through walls, through enclosures, through mountains, as though through space. One dives in and out of the earth as though it were water. One walks on water without sinking, as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, they travel in space like birds. Yeah, I did that just about a week ago. With their hands, they touch and stroke the moon and sun, so powerful and mighty, and they wield bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. Then the text uses the simile of a potter who might create different types of pots from clay, or an ivory worker who might prepare different types of works of art from ivory, or a goldsmith who might prepare different types of jewelry from gold. Okay, this might seem like myth and legends of ancient India, but to see how to develop these skills, I want to read or summarize a passage from Visuddhimagga which describes the techniques for developing the iddhis. And then maybe this will convince you that when the mind is developed in a certain way, it should become extremely powerful to the point where it can gain this mastery over nature. In earlier classes, we've gone through already, at least in discussion, not in actual experience, we've gone through the jhanas and the formless attainments, and also the kasinas. Okay, now, this is the preparation for developing the supernormal powers, according to the system of the commentaries, the Visuddhimagga. Okay, first we have eight kasinas. Remember the kasinas, the earth kasina, water kasina, fire kasina, air kasina. Then the color kasinas, blue, red, yellow, white kasina. Okay, what one has to do is to take a single jhana, the first jhana, and gain the first jhana in each of the eight kasinas. First one takes the earth kasina, and gains the first jhana in the earth kasina. Then one comes to the water kasina, fire kasina, air kasina, then the four color kasinas, till one comes to the white kasina. Then one goes in reverse. One gains the first jhana from the white kasina, then one comes to yellow, red, blue, then air element, fire element, water element, earth element. Then one goes back and forth in forward and reverse order, still using the first jhana. Okay, then one takes a single kasina object, starting with the earth kasina, and then one develops the eight jhanas, or the four jhanas, the four formless attainments, based upon that earth kasina object. And so with a single kasina object, one goes through the eight attainments. Then one takes the next kasina object and again goes through the eight attainments. I'm getting a little dizzy. Okay, one is on the earth kasina. One takes the eight attainments in direct order from first jhana, then up to the eighth base of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, then one starts from the base of neither perception nor non-perception based on the earth kasina. Then one works down from the fourth formless attainment to the base of neither, base of nothingness, base of infinite consciousness, base of infinite space, then fourth jhana, third jhana, second jhana, first jhana. Then one has to go very quickly in forward and reverse order based on the earth kasina. From the first jhana up to the eighth attainment, from the eighth attainment down to the first jhana. All on one kasina. Then one goes into the first jhana based upon the earth kasina. Then one goes through each of the jhanas, each of the eight jhanas, one goes through them and based upon each of the kasinas individually. So, and then masters all eight jhanas based upon all eight kasinas. Then one skips jhanas, one alternates jhanas without skipping the kasinas in the following way. One attains having first attained the first jhana in the earth kasina, one then attains the third jhana in the earth kasina. Then, having removed the earth kasina, one attains the base consisting of boundless space, then the base consisting of nothingness. It goes on like this. For several paragraphs describing the different skills, I don't want to go into all the details. Until one is able to go very, very quickly through all the jhanas and all of the kasinas, and then skip jhanas without skipping kasinas, then skipping kasinas without skipping jhanas. And so in this way, one is building up a tremendous, even an inconceivable mastery of the mind. And one is doing this very, very quickly so that one can go through this whole process even in a few seconds. And so after one has gone through all of this preparatory, this whole preparatory process, one is then able to gain this enormous reservoir of mental power. And then one directs the mind, which has that power, to the exercising of these supernormal powers. And then through the force of the intention, the force of the volition, based upon that samadhi, these supernormal powers can be exercised. Okay, so this is the practice of the iddhis, the supernormal powers. Then in paragraph 15, we come to the divine ear element. This is the ability. I'm going to go through these quickly, because I want to finish the sutta. We have to finish the sutta tonight. Okay, this is the divine air element, described as purified, surpassing the normal human ear. This is the ability to hear sounds, divine and human. One could hear sounds in the heavenly realms as well as in the human world, and one could hear sounds that are far away, even perhaps in sounds on the other side of the world as well as near. One doesn't need a telephone, but just through one's own yogic powers, one could hear sounds, voices, conversations. Then comes in paragraph 16, understanding the minds of others. This is being able to know the states of minds of others. It's not explained as reading the thoughts of others, though that I would assume that ability also arises, but as being able to understand the particular state of mind of others. And this is explained in terms of 16 states of mind. The most important are knowing a mind that's troubled by lust as troubled by lust, and a mind free from lust as free from lust. Understanding a mind that's troubled by hate as troubled by hate, and a mind free from hate as free from hate. Understanding a mind that's clouded by delusion as clouded by delusion. Understanding a mind free from delusion as free from delusion. And then there are a number of other pairs of states of mind that one could understand. Then the simile is given of a man or a woman who is able to view the image of his or her own face in a mirror. And if there was a spot in the mirror, the person would know there is a spot on my face. And if there is no spot on the face, the person would know there is no spot on my face. And so the disciple is able to know the minds, the state of mind of other beings. Okay, section 17 is the recollection of past lives. This is the ability to recollect one's many past lives, one birth, two births, three births, going back to one's past lives, even in many aeons, many past aeons, and being able to know the particular details of one's past lives. And the simile is given here in the sutta of a man who might go from his own village to another village, and then back from that village to his own village, and on doing so he might later recollect how he went from his own village to that village, and then back to his own village. And he might recall exactly what he did on each occasion. The Visuddhimagga explains the method for developing this knowledge. Very briefly, it involves first achieving mastery over the fourth jhana. Then from the fourth jhana consciousness, one emerges, then recalls what has taken place just before one sat down to meditate. One recalls maybe preparing one's seat, sitting down, entering into the fourth jhana. Okay, then one extends one's mind back. What took place before that? One might recall what took place earlier that day. Then one sends the mind back. What took place yesterday? One recalls some events that took place yesterday. What took place a few days ago, what took place last week, what took place a month ago. And so one is able to start recalling what took place last year. And then one is able to start recalling events that took place at longer and longer intervals. If the memory gets cloudy, one goes back into the fourth jhana, strengthens, calms, purifies the mind, comes out, again one starts recollecting what took place at earlier periods of time. And as one does so, one eventually comes back to the time of one's birth into this world. Then one sends the mind back past the moment of birth to the time when one was in the mother's womb. One starts recalling the period of development in the womb. One comes all the ways back to the moment of what's called the moment of rebirth linking, the first moment of consciousness in this life. Then when one tries to recollect what took place before that, it said one comes right up against the stone wall. But it said one doesn't give up, but again one goes into the jhana, makes the mind calm, focused, concentrated, very strong and sharp. Then one comes out and tries to recollect what took place before that moment, very moment of rebirth. And one uses that mind somewhat like a battering ram to break through that strong wall that obstructs the memory. And as one keeps on trying to recollect, eventually, through the force of the power of one's concentrated mind, that strong wall of forgetfulness collapses, and one is able to recollect the last moments of one's previous life. Then one starts sending the mind back to recollect events in one's that took place in one's previous life, till one can recollect very clearly what took place in one's immediately preceding life, till one comes back to the first moment of existence in that life. Then again one has to sharpen the power of the mind through the fourth jhana and try to recollect what took place before that. As one makes the effort, again the wall of forgetfulness breaks down and one can recollect the second preceding life. And thus one precedes, I think it's said that as one goes on, the skill develops till one is able to just start skipping over past lives, over many, many past lives, without much obstruction, until one can recollect many, many hundreds and maybe thousands of past lives. Okay, then the next comes paragraph section 18, the divine eye. The divine eye actually has several functions. One function is to be able to see events taking place in other realms of existence. According to the method of the Visuddhimagga, the meditator will use the light kasina. He develops the fourth jhana based on the light kasina, and then he uses the light kasina to radiate a bright light which is able to spread out and illuminate vast distances. And that light kasina, if there's a suitable, sufficient power of development behind it, will eventually extend to, the light will extend to other realms of existence, and so one will be able to see what is taking place in the heavenly realms, the ghostly realm, the hell realms. But one specific function of the divine eye is to see the consciousness of beings as they pass away from one state of existence, the present state of existence, and take rebirth in other states of existence, and to see how their rebirth takes place in accordance with their karma, with their actions in this existence. And that is what is described in paragraph 35. And this is illustrated by the simile of, suppose there were two houses with doors, and a man with good sight is standing there, and he sees people entering these houses and coming out and passing from one to the other. And so the meditator with the divine eye is able to see people coming out from one realm of existence and passing over to another realm of existence, and to understand why they pass from one realm to another, how their rebirth is governed by their karma, by their deeds. Okay, in section 19, we come to the destruction of the taints, of the defilements. And this direct knowledge, unlike the others, does not require the full development of all of these powers of samadhi. But this particular direct knowledge, the attainment of deliverance, can be achieved. Certainly it can be achieved based on any of the four jhanas, even based on the first jhana, according to the suttas, and according to the commentaries, it's even possible to achieve without attainment of any jhana, but based upon what is called access concentration, upachara samadhi. Okay, so I'll read this one. Again, O Dai, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way whereby, by realizing it for themselves with direct knowledge, they here and now enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind. It should be enter upon and abide and enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind. Deliverance by wisdom that is taintless with the destruction of the taints. It's actually one deliverance or one liberation called deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom. The translation here is a little misleading. It's not two deliverances, but it's one called Cheto Vimuti, Panya Vimuti. Anasavam Cheto Vimuti Panya Vimuti. It's a deliverance of mind that is also a deliverance by wisdom, and it is taintless because it comes about through the destruction of the taints. The taints are the root or most fundamental defilements of sensuality, craving for existence, and ignorance. And when they are destroyed, uprooted, then one is able to enter upon and dwell in this very special, very unique liberation of mind, achieved through the full development of wisdom. Then the simile is given of a lake in a mountain recess, the lake is clear, limpid, undisturbed, and a man with good sight standing on the bank would be able to look into the lake and see the shells, gravels, and pebbles, and the fish swimming about, and he would be able to identify each of these items very precisely. And so now, after going through all of these items, the Buddha says in paragraph 37, remember, we have to go back here, all the ways back to the five things on account of which the Buddha's disciples revere, honor, respect, and venerate him. And so now the Buddha has gone through all of these wholesome states that he teaches, these wholesome practices. And so now the Buddha says, this is the fifth quality because of which my disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate me, and live in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me. And then he says, summing them all up, he says, these are the five qualities. Then you have to go back to page 635 and 636 to get the five qualities. These are the five qualities because of which my disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate me, and live in dependence on me, honoring and respecting me. Then when he said that, the wanderer Udayi was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words, but unlike many others, he did not say, wonderful, venerable sir, excellent, venerable sir, I give up my former beliefs and I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. Please let the Venerable One accept me as a disciple from this day forward. Instead, he continued to be, because he was the leader of his own company, and so apparently he didn't want to give up his own status as a teacher and become a disciple of the Buddha. And so he just rejoiced in the Buddha's words without going any further. Okay, this is the end of the sutta. If there's any questions on anything, I went through rather quickly because I had to end today.
You may have probably said this already. I don't know, so I'll just look back in my notes. But all of these paragraphs under the fifth section end with Abhayad having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. Obviously, that can only apply to 19, destruction of the taints. Anything before that is not a consummation, perfection of direct knowledge, right?
I don't think that the Buddha would have praised the disciple for having reached perfection in any of these other direct knowledges if they hadn't also reached the destruction of the taints. But I think the phrase having reached perfection, just grammatically, and thereby many disciples of mine abide having reached the consummation perfection of direct knowledge, grammatically I think that has to be understood as applying only to each individual, to each direct knowledge individually. He's saying that the disciples have reached the perfection in each of these individually.
Perfection of direct knowledge of this thing that we're
yeah.
talking about in this
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned three major functions of the divine mind. One is to see the other realm. The second one is to see the intense and way. And the third one, based on their action.
I don't think I said three. I said that there are some other functions of the divine eye. I don't think I mentioned three, but I'll check on this, because the Visuddhimagga does give several functions of the divine eye. I know one that's mentioned in the Visuddhimagga is called knowledge of the future. So the divine eye is supposed to give knowledge of some future events. But let me just check on this. Oh, okay. The divine eye, called knowledge of passing away and reappearance, has two accessory kinds of knowledge. Knowledge of the future and knowledge of faring according to deeds. I want to see if it gives some explanation of this. I think what it means, knowledge of passing away and rebirth would just be the ability to see beings passing away and being reborn. But that would not necessarily show that one would not necessarily see that the beings are being reborn in accordance with their karma. But also with the divine eye, another knowledge that might arise through the divine eye is the knowledge that these beings have been reborn in such a state because of their karma. So that is an additional knowledge. And through the divine eye, one also gains some knowledge of future events. It doesn't go into any detail about what's meant there. And also, I've read elsewhere that through the divine eye, one is able to see events taking place in other realms of existence. So that's another aspect of that knowledge.
In the process of passing away and rebirth, is that instantaneous, or is there an interval?
Oh, this is a somewhat controversial issue. There are different opinions between the different schools. My own view is that probably in the case of a human rebirth, that there's some interval between a death and another human rebirth, so that the being would be in something like an intermediate state. Probably in passing away from the human realm to a divine realm, a heavenly realm, or to a hell realm, I would think it very possible in that case that the rebirth can be instantaneous.
In the paragraph on the kinds of supernatural power, there's this being becoming many and then becoming one.
Yeah.
Is that an extension of the mind-made body? Is that a different sort of...
It's considered a different power, though it seems to have something in common with the mind-made body.
It's the mind-made body has these specific, it has to have all its limbs, it has to have all its faculties. Are those same requirements put in for the many becoming one?
Yeah. When one's own body becomes many, those many bodies look exactly like one's own body. So that I don't actually see why the mind-made body should be mentioned as a separate power or separate knowledge, once the ability to become many is mentioned. It's just perhaps that in the Buddha's time, that was considered like a separate yogic achievement, and so the Buddha included it within his own system as a separate achievement. But in the case of the ability to project many copies of one's own body, there's the famous story. Okay, I'll just tell it very quickly. There was one monk, disciple of the Buddha, his name was Chulapuntaka. He had very, very dull memory. He could not remember anything, even a single verse. And he had an older brother. They both became monks. And Chulapuntaka, he could not remember even a four-line verse. And so his brother told him, if you can't remember this four-line verse, I'm going to make you give up the monkhood. You'll have to go out of the Sangha. And so Chulapuntaka was very, very sad, very upset. And one day the Buddha came by, saw him very upset, and said, "Why are you so upset?" And Chulapuntaka said, "My brother told me that I have to memorize this four-line verse, and when I memorize the first two lines, and I come to the second two lines, I forget the first two lines, so my case is lost." Then the Buddha said, "Don't worry, don't worry. I'm not even going to give you even four lines to memorize. Can you just memorize three words? All you have to do is take a piece of cloth, rub it with your fingers, and repeat the words, 'Removal of dirt, removal of dirt.'" And Chulapuntaka said, "Okay, I will do that." Okay, then he took the piece of cloth and held it between his fingers and rubbed it and kept on reciting the words, "Removal of dirt, removal of dirt." And while he was reciting this, he noticed that the cloth became dirty and dirty and dirty. And he was wondering, where is this dirt coming from? Then he realized, it's coming from my own body. Then he realized, that is the nature of this body. It seems to be clean and pure, but even it holds this clean cloth, and within a few minutes, the cloth becomes soiled because of this body. Then stood up, he just focused his mind inwardly, and somehow through his previous paramis, he went into focusing upon the cloth, he mastered the jhanas, the formless attainments. Then he developed this power of multiplying his body, and so he was able to send out many, many copies of his body so that the whole of the monastery was filled with copies of his own body. Then somebody came to invite the Sangha to an almsgiving, and he wanted to invite Chulapuntaka, and he saw so many Chulapuntakas in the monastery, he didn't know which one to invite. So he went to the Buddha, the man who wanted to invite the monks to the almsgiving. He went to the Buddha and said, "I want to invite Chulapuntaka, but there are so many of them, I don't know which one to invite." The Buddha said, "You just grab hold of the robe of the first one that you see and say, 'I invite you to the almsgiving.'" And so then he grabbed hold of the first Chulapuntaka's robe that he saw and said, "I invite you to the almsgiving." Then all of the other Chulapuntakas disappeared and only that one remained. Okay, we have to stop now. Okay, we end by sharing the merits.
Akasata chabumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata devanagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparam etavata chammehi sampadang punyasampadang Sabe deva anumodantu Sabha sampati siddhya Etavata champehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabe bhuta anumodantu Sabha sampati siddhya Etavata champehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabe sata anumodantu Sabha sampati siddhya